I was asked to speak on the exhibition that I organized for the Whitney in 1996, Making Mischief, Dada Invades New York. I don't know whose idea it was actually to ask me to do this, whether it was Anne or Adrian, but I'm grateful for the fact that you did, because I'm generally reluctant to speak at all anymore or to present papers and do things like this since I opened a gallery and hardly seem to have time for that this kind of stuff. But I love the idea of speaking about this particular exhibition for one reason, because I was told that I had to speak about it as a kind of, well, they didn't say how I had to talk about it, but it was recalling that particular event. And it struck me that it's like the things you see at the end of a DVD. You know, you get that little special features section. If you want to know more about the movie, you go there. And now there's a whole industry in Hollywood that produces these kinds of things. So I thought, well, you know, I'll do my own little, that's 10 years later, but I'll do my own little behind-the-scenes explanation of how this exhibition came into being and what were my intentions and the results. So that was the reason I wholeheartedly accepted the invitation. I also loved calling it the making of Making Mischief. I love alliterations. I mean, the title itself, Making Mischief, was, but the making of Making Mischief, that sent me into another dimension. So I that got me. And if I have a good title, I like to go with it. So the idea of this exhibition I had in mind since the 1970s when I first started doing research on New York Dada, and actually a chance encounter with David Ross, who was a newly appointed director at the Whitney Museum, and a meeting with him resulted in this exhibition in 1992. It took 4.5 years to put it together, which also strikes me as an amazing thing. I just heard Mr. Rotka mention at lunch that the exhibition he did in Dusseldorf in 1958 took 4 weeks, and 7,000 people came. The exhibitions these days take 4 and 5 years, and at last count, I think 200,000 people came to see it in Washington and maybe more here, and 400,000 in Paris. And as I just told John Elderfield at lunch, if this keeps happening, it means in the year 2050, we're going to get millions of people going to Dada exhibitions. It's going to take 25 years to do it, so we should probably get started soon. Now, I was very happy to accept this invitation to do the exhibition at the Whitney because I was in the process of finishing my own book on New York Dada. And I struggled for years writing this book, wondering how it should be organized, and I decided upon a sort of thematic approach, but it was chronology. I kept wanting a kind of chronological approach, so I decided, well, this is perfect. The catalog I can do as a chronology, and the book I'll continue to do in a thematic way, and that's, in fact, what happened in the end. During the process of organizing the exhibition, not much happened the first 2 years except to go rushing around and make sure I got the critical loans. And, of course, that meant with David Ross going to the Philadelphia Museum of Art and begging them to cooperate with us as much as possible because the greater part of what I had to borrow would come from them. The Arensberg collection was crucial, and I knew that I would have to not only borrow the Dada artifacts from their collection, but also works that the Arensbergs happened to have owned, because I had in the back of my mind this idea of reconstructing the apartment of Walter and Louise Arensberg. I wanted to do it in a fashion similar to the way it was done in the German Dada Messe that we just heard about, because I was intent on doing just that. I found the original apartment. I went over with carpenters and took impressions of the moldings. The apartment itself had changed, but the apartment above it was still the same. I measured everything. We were going to go for it and do it as accurately as possible. That didn't happen, and I'll explain why a little bit later, but I think it didn't happen in part because I should have hired her, or I should have hired someone who was a little bit more strong-willed, or maybe any German, because I didn't get there. I just, it didn't happen. Anyway, about 3 years into the process, the Whitney hired another person, a curator within the museum, to help me. I had been begging for that all along, and they hired a young woman named Beth Venn. At first, I resisted her partnership in this because I wanted it to be a one-man affair. I thought that this was something I'd worked on for years. I regret now having resisted when I did, because she was a great help. She pushed things along right when they needed to be pushed, and probably the greatest contribution that she made was to hire a designer for the exhibition. She helped get the financing for the exhibition, so I'll always be indebted to her. But Beth came to me one day and she said, well, let's get a designer now for the exhibition. And I said, well, what are you nuts? I'm the curator. I'll design it. You know, like I could do this. And she said, no, we need to get someone serious to do this, you know, who has experience. So I said, all right, you know, you want to do it. They have the budget. Okay, we'll do it. So she contacted three architects and made appointments. I was allowed to call them to tell them more or less what I wanted. And then we were going to go see what came of that. We gave them 2 months to do it in. And I will never forget how this happened. It was really a great revelation for me because the results of this exhibition, the way it appeared in the end, came from this experience. The first architectural, I called them up and I said, look, you, each person, all three of them, I said, there's only two requirements I'm going to make. One, you have to read my book on New York Dada. That was a mistake. Architects and designers, I don't know, maybe they got into the profession because reading was something they didn't want to do, but anyway, they didn't read my book, needless to say. However, the second one was that whatever you come up with, whatever design you give me, I don't want someone to go into the floor of the Whitney, see the exhibition, then be able to walk back onto the elevator, turn to the person they sit next to and say something about the design of the exhibition. I didn't want it to be so predominant a design that it would become another artwork in its own right. That was the only requirement I had. So anyway, to make this long story short, I won't exceed the 25 minutes, by the way. If I do, just don't clap, throw things at me. I don't want to exceed the time limit I have here. But anyway, we go down to see these architects, and the first firm was some big firm on 57th Street, nice big-time office building, and they assigned two people to do this exhibition, and I sat down with them, and they laid out the plans, and it was just like little cubes, you know. It was the Whitney floor broken up in all these little cubes, and he said, well, you know, they took the chapters in my book and said, well, pre-Dada goes here, that goes there, and I said, what, did you read my book? I said, and then they confessed they didn't, and I walked out. And then I went to another architect. Almost the same thing happened. I can't remember what it was, but we went to a third guy, a guy named Chris Hubert. Now, some of you may even know this man. He's a great designer. And he was wonderful because he did read my book. And when I came in, he laid out the plans. And this was the last of the people we were going to see. So I was placing all my hope in this guy. And he lays out the first big sheet of paper. I remember it was this big. And it had on it a huge circle, like concentric circles, well, like openings all the way around it. And it was circles. I said, well, what's this? And he said, well, it's like Duchamp's bicycle wheel, you know, it's got a big circle like this. And I said, but first of all, he was violating the first thing I asked him. I didn't want something that you could memorize and talk about. And I said, well, where's the art going there? And he goes, well, it goes in these little holes around. I said, you're giving me the problem of the Guggenheim, and we're not there. I can't understand why you don't get it, you know. And then he puts out another sheet of paper, and it's more or less the same thing, but a spiral. He said, you know, like Duchamp's spiral, the roto relief. And I said, yeah, and I'm just about giving up. And as I get up to leave, I was really angry by then, he turns to the last page, and there on a giant sheet of paper are scrawls, really like deep impressions in the paper. And I said, what's that? He said, I don't know. I put it up on my wall, and I just blindfolded myself, and I scratched at it. And it was the most magical experience of my life. In one moment, it came to life, the whole exhibition, the layout, everything was right on that sheet of paper. Nothing changed. It really was remarkable. What, of course, I didn't realize is that guy's smart as hell. He was setting me up. He knew he was going to give me two bad things before he was going to give me what he knew was going to happen. And I fell for it as deeply as you can fall. The exhibition, the one quality of this exhibition, its most unique feature really in the end, was its layout. And I take very little credit for that because we put the walls more or less exactly where those scratches were on the sheet of paper. Everything fit. I knew things fit when you give them spaces to go. You don't necessarily have to design the space first. The things almost gravitated right to where they needed to be. The one good thing I recognized right away in this scratching on the paper was in the middle was a kind of void. And I knew that when you come off the elevator, you look straight across, and that's where I wanted Duchamp's large glass to be, because I knew right behind that was a window. And some of you may already know this, that when the reconstruction of the large glass was made by Ulf Linde in Stockholm, Duchamp went to visit it in the 1961, and he said he thought that behind it should be some element of nature. So whenever the Moderne Musette displays this work, there's a plant or something else behind it. And the man who came and gave us this, this is the actual reconstruction of that reconstruction, it's the third one, he said, look, you've got to, he showed me the guy who comes and installs this, which is extremely expensive, maybe part of the reason it doesn't get borrowed a lot. It was at the Pompidou exhibition where they beautifully put it against Paris, and you could see Montmartre and Sacré-Cœur in the background. Couldn't be better. But I didn't have that. I had just that little window. And I said, look, so I actually wanted to buy plants, and they wouldn't let me do it at the Whitney because they give off something, I don't know, whatever it was. They didn't want it near the artwork. So I actually approached the man who lives in the apartment right directly across the street. He got it, and we put four plants in his window. And they were there through the duration of the exhibition. Very few people caught that little detail. Art News did, and they did a little feature on the plants. It was, as it turned out, the guy was a dentist. His wife was a tour guide at the Whitney, so they'd do anything. But he asked if he could put a little nude sculpture of a woman that he made in the corner of the room, and of course, in the window. So I jumped at it. It's the bride stripped bare, after all, so there she was in the corner. So that was a wonderful little touch that few people who came to the exhibition even knew about. Now, you can see that I have the large glass in the center, the Man Ray on one wall, these very oblique walls. I love that. The only thing they had to change in the exhibition design, because I was really insisting they follow these scratches on the paper as closely as possible, is that when a wall got to be within 12 inches of another wall, we had to move it, because people see that little space and inevitably they try to go through it, and some people don't make it through 12 inches, so they get stuck, and we had to, that's the only thing really that got changed in this. Otherwise, it's exactly what you see. You can see the tomb, which I was very happy to have borrowed from Yale up there in the beginning, the shovel, and then on the left, you have the new descending, and around that corner starts the pre-Dada works. That first one that's barely visible there is Man Ray's War. Now, if you advance the slide on the left, there's the pre-Dada room where you can see the Man Ray works, including the five figures owned by the Whitney there. And I could make just one comment on this whole notion of pre-Dada, which came up a couple of times here already. I've never objected to its use whenever it was introduced, in part because I don't really object to the whole notion of Dada and when it existed. People say, well, there was no Dada in New York, which is... Man Ray can say that because he was trying to express his opinion about how Dada did not take hold and have a great success. But on the other hand, Dada had to have happened. They had a knowledge of it almost immediately after the word was invented. Within 6 months, they knew the word Dada in New York. But then, of course, you could now argue, well, then how about the works that predate 1916? What are they doing in the context of Dada? Well, why not? I mean, I think it's because we think in visual terms. Cubist works had to exist before the word cubism was invented, didn't it? Didn't they? They had to. The word, the Louis Vauxhall's couldn't say, you know, fauve if he didn't have something, the Donatello sculpture, to compare to the, was it the Matisse or Braque? I can't remember. But these things had to have existed before the word was used and applied to them. So certainly calling things in, you know, in that context, pre-Dada, it doesn't certainly bother me, and I don't still to this day quite wholly understand the objections. Anyway, next slide on the right should be, this is the room, and this was an idea that came, that Beth Venn came up with. She wanted all of the people who were involved with Dada to be represented in portraits. So there's a kind of Dada portrait room, and she wrote an essay on that for the catalog. But right around that corner and behind that wall was a perfect space in Chris Hubert's diagram where I could fit what I thought would be the cornerstone of the entire exhibition, and that's the slide on the left. That's the, can you advance the slide on the left? Yes. This is the reconstruction of the apartment in Walter and Louise Arensberg on West 67th Street. Now, As I said, I took great pains. We even took the impressions of the moldings, but we threw everything out in the end because, let's say, the powers that be at the Philadelphia Museum decided that we couldn't borrow their works and use them just for illustrative purposes. You can't take their great Picasso, and unless you hang it on the wall with everything else. But if I hung it on the wall with everything else, I'd be putting that Picasso in a Dada context and screwing everybody up. So it didn't make any sense to me to do that. So we negotiated, argued, in effect, back and forth till I got my final checklist. It wasn't everything in the apartment, but then I came up with what I think in the end ended up being really a better idea. I decided to since all of the walls of the Arensberg apartment were carefully photographed by Charles Sheeler, we blew them up into 18-foot-high photographs at a cost, I still remember, of $33,000. But it was magical. I hung the actual works where they were, but when the work wasn't there, unlike the case with the Berlin reconstruction, I left it there. So you can't see, it's hard to guess what's a photograph and what is a real work of art hanging on that wall. Only when you really viewed it obliquely at an angle could you tell what was there and what wasn't. And it worked perfectly. It was really the cornerstone of what New York Dada was for me. It was the nightly soirees that took place in that apartment, and I wanted that room to come alive to the extent it was possible within the context of a museum setting. So I set up a chess table there and invited people to play chess. They wanted me to put a plastic vitrine over it, but it was a friend of mine helped and bought a cheap chess set for me downtown. And I bought 5 chess sets thinking people would steal the pieces. Well, not one piece was stolen through the duration of the entire exhibition, and people played chess in that room on a regular basis, which of course they did in the apartment originally. Now, if you advance the next slide on the right, there was a room just opposite this, and I don't know, a space anyway, not really a room, where the ready-mades hung, and the Baroness Elsa Freytag von Loringhoven's works were exhibited, but unfortunately it was not recorded. The photographer somehow turned, skipped it, did the machinist room instead. So you have the machinist Picabius, Covert, Schomburg's, the Stella, and you advance again on the right, you go around that corner at the end, and you end up in a room which is more or less what I considered the New York room. Man Ray's New York sculpture, Florian Stettheimer's New York there in the corner, and even Sheeler's Manhattan, the film you can see in a continuous, in other pictures. Another slide on the right, opposite that was the so-called sort of New York Dada corner where the urinal and everything that has to do with the Independence Exhibition of 1917, like the Blind Man magazine and all of that, the magazines are in there. There's a urinal, and I love the way Chris Hubert came up with this method of displaying the urinal, because I had mentioned to him when Robert Motherwell's book came out in 1951, it's amazing how often that has been referred to in the context of this symposium, Duchamp said, I threw the urinal in their face, and now they're telling me the ready-mades are beautiful works of art. He wrote that in a letter to Richter, and I mentioned that to Chris Hubert, so he pushed the urinal into our faces. You couldn't really touch it, but it still stuck out into the middle of the room on that floating platform. There were a couple of spaces that you can't see here where I cut holes in the wall and had the glass work so that you could see through them on the other side. And if you advance the next slide on the right, that's just a little reading room, the didactic section at the end. Now, how much time do I have? I don't want to get hit with anything, so I don't. Do I have 10 minutes? Okay, I just wanted to make sure I had more time because I want to get hit. Next 2 slides. I did invite you to do that. The reason, aside from the installation of the exhibition, I wanted to say something about the catalog and what was really my ultimate underlying intent. As I gathered works for this exhibition, I started to think about what is it that they have in common. There is a difference. There's a real difference. You can walk through the rooms upstairs and you'll see it yourself. You walk through the Zurich room, there's a strong influence of cubism, and into the Berlin room and the kind of political quality that you get from these works. And then finally you hit the New York room or where the Duchamp works are displayed and something different happens. There's a different sensibility, something working in that New York room. And was it simply what everybody kept saying, that we didn't have a war going on in New York? And I sort of resented that attitude because we did have a war going on in New York. After all, Man Ray, when in 1914 he made the painting War, he did so because a woman he had just married had seven brothers and sisters in Belgium. You remember what happened to Belgium at the beginning of the First World War. It was decimated, so she thought her whole family was dead, and that's a response to it. So New York Dada artists were making works in direct response to the war, or say Man Ray's Madonna. So, and obviously we were aware of it. In fact, most of these guys were here because of it. So it's, you know, it's not as if you leave the actual battlefield in the front, but it doesn't mean it goes out of your mind any more than the war we're in right now is out of anyone's mind, really, and maybe the reason why there is an interest in Dada. I do believe those events run parallel. Anyway, as I tried to figure out what is the cohesive element, I decided, well, there is something. There is a lightheartedness. There's a kind of humor in a lot of the works, and I tried to single out which works they were in my introduction to the catalog. I started with this one, which I'm very happy to say in the catalog introduction. I said it's by an artist about which little is known, and in fact, nothing was known of him at the time. His name, you can see in the corner, is B-O-I-X, and I was just taught a few moments ago that he pronounced it Bouche, which is a strange way to pronounce it to French ears anyway, but anyway, that's how it's pronounced, Richard Bouche. And I also didn't know how he fell into this context, and Adrian Sedalter has just provided that information as well. He lived in the same room on 8th Street where Man Ray's house was. He was a boarder in that house, so they must have gotten to know each other. He was around 24 years old when he was invited to this Dada event where Catherine Dreyer, at the Société Anonyme, asked everyone to answer the question, what is Dada? And I provide a pretty thorough account of what occurred on that particular occasion. But what I want to concentrate on here is, what is the humorous aspect that comes out of this? The artist here, I think, was trying to draw an Arkhipenko there on the left. And if you advance a slide on the left, I think I found which work he was probably looking at. Though, if you look carefully, he's put an apple in one hand and a little cup dangling from the other. I guess that's the way he thought of Dada. And using Arkhipenko is rather interesting because he had an exhibition at the Société Anonyme in 1920, and everybody was calling him Dada when he isn't at all, but they didn't know what word to use. If you advance the next two slides, you'll see that Arkhipenko was used as a point of ridicule to an extent by Duchamp. And in this time, it's his name. There's the work I found, the source work on the left. But this is designed by Duchamp and appeared in Arts Magazine in 1921. And as you can see, it's the Archipenko. And it's hilarious if you read the rest of this. And I also tried to make the point in the catalog, if you advance the next two slides, that even possibly the invention of Rose C'est la Vie could have had its source in the great humorist of the time, Charlie Chaplin. His film, called A Woman, came out in 1915 and was actually shown in New York the very month that Duchamp arrived. And he became fascinated by Charlie Chaplin, everybody did, and he even wrote about Chaplin in various letters to friends saying, have you seen the most recent Charlie? I have no doubts that he saw this film. I don't know how deeply ingrained it was in his mind when he came up with Rose C'est la Vie, but it's a rather interesting little point. If you see the film ever, Charlie tries to get into a boarding house where his girlfriend is, and he can't get in because he's not a girl. So he decides to dress up like a girl, and one of the very rare times in a Charlie Chaplin film, he takes off his little, as we now know, painted mustache, and dressed in a way that is strikingly similar, as I see it anyway, to Rose C'est la Vie 6 years later, but at any rate. Now, having said that, identifying this, what I said was one of the more salient aspects of New York Dada, I got resoundingly attacked in the press when the show opened by quite a few critics, but one stands out above all others, and I'm sure he's not here, Hilton Kramer. He was unbelievably relentless. He said that this was the big sham. Duchamp hates Dada to begin with, but then he had the perfect person to hate in me, because here I am trying to give it some kind of scholarly credibility, but I'm writing about humor. Now, I say even in the essay that you can't write about humor and be humorous because it's the, you know, you're dissecting the joke in effect. And in fact, I actually think that, you know, art historians are in a sense to art what a joke analyst is to a joke. You know, if you start to talk about the work and you rip it apart and you kill it. And that's the problem. And Hilton Kramer seized on it, called me totally humorless. And I've heard his lectures. I can say now quite honestly the same about him. And luckily, friends of mine wrote to the press and tried to defend me. But at any rate, that seemed, and it seems that when you try to tell people that there's humor in a work of art, they don't take it seriously anymore. It is really remarkable. I actually asked Kurt Barnadeau when he was here if he would consider doing an exhibition on just humor and art, because it would expose it, because artists have a great sense of humor, and it's behind so many works of art. But he had got killed with his high-low show, and he wasn't about to go do something like that again. But it's still an idea, one worth, I think, considering. Now I'm done. Thank you. Now, I don't know if any of you have questions, or is it... I'd just as soon see you go home early. Well, that worked. Okay, I'm out of here.